John Hoppenthaler's previous books of poetry are Lives of Water, Anticipate the Coming Reservoir, both with Carnegie Mellon University Press. With Kazim Ali, he co-edited a volume of essays called Gene Valentine, This World Company. He is an editor of Connotation Press, and this is his third book of poetry, Domestic Garden. John, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Well, I'm glad to be back.
Congratulations on your third book of poems, Domestic Garden, put out by Carnegie Mellon University Press. And this is the first chance we got to talk about it, so I'm very excited. You read here about, maybe it was about 2 years ago, from your first book, Anticipate the Coming Reservoir, or your second book, I guess it was, Anticipate
That's right.
the Coming Reservoir. And you also read some poems from the forthcoming Domestic Garden, which is now out. And you're a fantastic reader, and you're a great performer, so I imagine you have a lot of fun when you're in front of the audience.
I really love it. I mean, as you know, it's a, you know, being a performer of various sorts yourself, it's a different skill set than the actual writing, and, you know, it just kind of calls on different parts of yourself to go out there and inhabit these poems in a way that you know, can be entertaining to an audience.
Do you think being good in both, the presenting of it and the writing of it, are necessary for a poet today?
I don't know if it's necessary. I think there are some terrific poets out there whose work I love on the page, but if you hear them read, they're not terribly exciting.
Right. I can think of a few. You're right.
But then again, there are those poets who are, you know, you hear them read and maybe you're not familiar with their work on the page and they sound wonderful, but then when you get the book and you look at the poems on the page, they're not that interesting on the page. So to me, you know, my favorite poets are those that kind of can do both.
Their
poems exist dynamically on the page, and then when you go hear them read, it adds perhaps another layer to what you've already, you know, gotten from the work.
Yeah, and there's an illusion from people who aren't writers that writers get a book and then they just kind of sit back and everybody reads it and then they write another book. But that's not the reality, especially in poetry.
That's right. And, you know, I mean, so we've already talked about the two hats, right? The writer and then the performance aspect of it. And the third hat, of course, is the salesperson, the business manager,
right.
and these things all really have to coexist if you're going to have anything like book sales when it comes
absolutely.
To poetry. Because, as you say, you mean you go to a typical bookstore and poetry books are not represented well.
Right.
You know, so unless you have some particular fans out there who are just dying for your next book, you know, you pretty much have to go out and hawk your wares out on the trail, which isn't unlike, you know, many musical performers, you know, contemporary folk rock singers and such. They have a circuit, a club circuit, and that's pretty much what poets do, too. They kind of go out on the road, on the circuit, and I like that.
Yeah.
it keeps me in touch with my reader in a way that I think others might not enjoy.
Oh, absolutely. And you're good at it, like I said. You're funny. You make people laugh and you invite us into your poems and it's a great experience. I was having lunch the other day with some poets. You know them all, I'm sure. Lee Herrick and Tim Z. Hernandez, who also teaches over here, and Michael Medrano. We were all sitting around in a Mexican restaurant in Fresno and I was telling them, oh, guess what? I just got I'm going to get another royalty check. And all the poets, because they were all poets, they go, royalty check, like, what's that? and then I says, well, that means that I've paid off my advance. And they go, advance, what's that?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, they're definitely different worlds. And, you know, I mean, part of that has to do with, you know, the poor job America does generally to create an environment where poetry is understood.
And
most people who come to a poem don't know what to do with it,
right.
Particularly a contemporary poem. And they just haven't been given the tools. And I find when I get students here that once they're given the various keys that might unlock the work, then they're able to enjoy it. And, you know, my favorite thing when I'm out on the road is, you know, that those people in an audience that were kind of forced to be there, well, you have to come because it's our class.
Right, yeah.
And then for a few of them, you see like a light bulb go off. And you know, they might look angry and they might look, you know, petulant at first. But then at the end, they come up and say, you know, there's nothing like what I thought it would be.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
I kind of like that, you know. And, you know, so I think a lot of our young people have this false impression of what poetry might be or what it is. and you know, many of them just don't know how to deal with it, how to approach it. And it's not unlike going to a museum and, well, how do you understand this abstract art as opposed to the still life of a, you know, some fruit in a bowl? You know, there are different tools that you have to bring to the task.
Yeah. You know, to coattail on what you're saying, I think a lot of times when people who don't know how to read poetry, or are, let me just put it another way, who aren't as familiar with poetry, they try to immediately go into it and pull out a meaning,
that's,
you know,
right,
as if it were an equation. And I think in poetry, you have to enter into it. You have to enter into it like a child, you know, but you're not going to lose your intelligence as an adult. But if you enter into it as a child, the landscape becomes alive. And I feel that the best book or poems are the ones that I could enter into. And I definitely was able to walk into Domestic Garden. And I looked around and I thought it was a great experience. Congratulations on this fantastic book. I want to ask you something about the first opening poem, which is the title poem, Domestic Garden. And I'm thinking about the structure of this book, which I have a lot of questions about that, because the experience was fantastic. And it's in five sections, but before we get to the first section, we have this poem called, well, Domestic Garden. Can you tell us why you started with that poem, and at what point in the process of putting this book together you knew that would be the first?
Yeah, so I think the poem informs the rest of the book in a variety of ways, as do the couple of epigraphs that I use for the book as well. This was a poem that I wrote fairly early in the process of putting together this third book, and I already had another sequence of poems that's in the book. That there's a sequence of sonnets and haiku in there. So suddenly I had these two gardening poems, and I wrote them both nearly at the same time. And I'm not a gardener. My mom was a gardener. My wife's not a gardener. I mean, we kill anything we try to grow. But this idea of the garden became interesting to me, and as the book developed, several things were happening. One was I was entering a domestic relationship, and I got married late in life, just before I turned 50. And so I was, you know, unused to that lifestyle. I was scared of it.
Right.
You know, I embrace it in a lot of ways, but, you know, I had to work my way through it. So this book has a lot to do with that. And so, in a way, I felt that kind of emerged, like, you know, it's kind of an Adam and Eve thing going on.
Absolutely.
Clearly, you know, as part of this. But then there's also the domesticity of a garden, and whether it be a food garden or decorative. And so just as a general theme, the idea of the garden just kept growing and growing, and poems just kept coming out that addressed it in various ways. So that's kind of what was going on. And so this particular poem harkens back in some ways to my mom and her love of roses. And I just thought, you know, what if, you know, like my life has kind of been, some jokester has kind of played a joke on me, you know. Here I was, you know, a bachelor, and suddenly I've got this new life. It's kind of like some jokester switched my title, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, that poem just kind of comes out of that in a variety of ways.
Well, I could really relate to that. I've been single for several years, and then I just got into a domestic relationship. And we have a house in the suburbs, and I take the garbage out every Thursday, and I wave to my neighbors as I'm walking to my car.
And
there's a lot of challenges in it when you're so used to, you know, that space alone. And I could definitely see that.
That's right.
Especially with the poem, The Garden of Eden, which is the next poem. Section one, it's about a garden, but it's also about paradise. I mean, the Garden of Eden clearly is Adam and Eve, and it's about a relationship. But is this a pessimistic poem?
I don't think so. I wanted to remove the romantic notions. I had this book with all these gardening poems in it, you know, or a lot of gardening poems in it, and I thought, all right, people are going to go, oh, Garden of Eden, Garden of Eden. So I wanted to address that
absolutely
directly.
That's smart.
Yeah, so, you know, so I did that, and so this couple is a version of my parents, who moved from New York City to the suburbs then, and built this life, you know, including gardens with gates around, fences around them.
Right.
And so that's kind of them, and of course, you know, it was a difficult life for them. They had to make a lot of sacrifices, and I wanted that, you know, non-religious Garden of Eden to come out of this. And that's why, even though my father was religious, I lie in the poem. You know, he was religious, but my mom wasn't. But I wanted it to be more of a secular Garden of Eden, where that might speak to more people.
I heard somewhere, and I've never checked this to make sure it's true, but I assume it is, that the word for paradise in Arabic is connected to walled garden, the image of a walled garden.
Mm.
In essence, when we enter into an imaginary garden, when it's created in an imaginary landscape or a poetic landscape, we're entering into the past. We're entering into a time, you know, a prelapsarian poetic time, I guess you can say. And you do that with this book. The garden constantly leads you back to your mother, constantly leads you back to your father. The images of any kind of flower or roses, there's a lot of roses, it leads you back to these memories, but these memories are not necessarily these pure paradisical memories. They're oftentimes very painful. And I'm thinking of that poem about your father, and I'm assuming that the speaker of the poem is you, because it seems to be in so many of the poems. It's a very painful memory. And was it difficult to write that particular poem? I think it's called Last Father's Day.
Well, okay, so I'm a poet who you have to distrust the eye.
Oh, okay, good. I'm glad you told me that.
But that said, so my first, I'm largely a poet who writes, you know, fictions. There might be a fact or two that is quote-unquote true, but then I create this, you know, this world around it that is a totally imaginative act. And so that poem is actually fully imaginative.
Wow, I am shocked, because it is so believable.
Yeah, however, this book of my three books contains the most poems that are, quote-unquote, more true to my own autobiography than my first two books. So, you know, that waterfall poem, for example, that brings my father into it. Now, that poem has a lot to do with reality. That actually, you know, is something that I would do. But yeah, Last Father's Day is absolutely a fiction.
Jeez, it's very convincing, especially there's this one detail in it that just really struck me as opening the poem up, and that's when he's drinking white Zinfandel instead of Bud.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, and then I've done my job. So to me, you know, it's you know, God is in the details, and it's if you can, you know, be confident about these details and create a texture of character action and sensory details and create a world that the reader or the person who's hearing you read can enter, then they'll buy it, you know, and
then they'll
see it, you know. So, you know, you're a fiction writer largely, and you go out and you know, give a reading, and no one says, well, is that true? But, you know, for some reason, people, you know, think all poets should be writing poems that are, you know, autobiographical, and
I just
don't do it that much, because my own life isn't all that interesting.
Well, you know, I mean, I totally agree. I know there is, you know, in some circles of poetry, you know, that kind of like almost like a schism between those who think it should be autobiographical and those who don't. But I think what really matters is the truth that comes out of the language and the images. That certainly happens in your poems. Let's talk a little bit about the side porch of the Elizabeth Bishop House. This is a really interesting poem. It goes back and forth from the public to the personal, only the public is the image, the public figure of Elizabeth Bishop. And then the personal, though, is the speaker of the poem. Did you do research on this poem? And how did you identify with her life, with the life of the speaker?
Yeah. So this is a poem where the parts, you know, where that's largely autobiographical. The Bishop stuff came because I got a fellowship to stay at the Elizabeth Bishop House in Nova Scotia for a week.
Oh, so you actually slept in her bed, like another poem.
I did.
Oh, my God, I'm going to ask you about that. But yeah, please go ahead.
And so in preparation for this, I read some Bishop, you know, and particularly her prose, which I hadn't really read. And so there was a couple of stories, one in particular called Primer, that gave a lot of information about her life and about her mother's collapse into madness. And my own mother had a moment in her life where she kind of collapsed into madness. It was, you know, relatively short-lived, but it happened, and it had a big effect on me as a child, and that's brought to bear in the poem. So so all of the details about Elizabeth Bishop are really from her own work, and then so there's that juxtaposition of her details and my details, and how, you know, there's a confluence there of our mothers, and hers didn't come out of it the way mine did. But, you know, now my mom is in a nursing home and is, you know, deeply into the grips of dementia and Alzheimer's and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so she's just not there, and that all kind of comes out in this poem. The longest poem I've ever written, by the way.
I was going to ask you about that, because when I first encountered that poem, I thought, well, this is a long one. And but when I entered into it, I got out the other side very quickly. I mean, it doesn't read like a long poem. But, yeah, it is longer than, I think, every other poem in the book.
Yeah, no, certainly, like I said, the longest poem I've ever written. I tend to write, you know, one-pagers. But this one just kept going for me. And, you know, I guess the sections and the two stories being told, you know, had something to do with that. But
I'm talking to John Hoppenthaler, Domestic Garden, and the poem that evokes Elizabeth Bishop, her house and being on the porch and then going back and forth from her life really to the speaker of the poem. And earlier, there's a poem called Sleeping in Elizabeth Bishop's Bedroom. And at first, what I thought is that you visited her house and saw the bedroom, like, you know, like I remember I was in Stratford-on-Avon last summer, and I saw Shakespeare's bed, you know, and it's probably not his real bed, but, and then, you know, you go into places, you see Hemingway's bed in Cuba and, you know, and all this stuff, and you can't help but to imagine sleeping in the bed of somebody like that and what dreams they might have and those dreams mixing into your dreams. And I kind of think that's what's going on in the poem. But you literally slept in her bed?
I did, and there's like a little skylight above the bed. It's a small bed, and it's a small room, and it's in between, you know, a regular-sized bedroom where my wife and stepson were sleeping, and down the hall is the room where her mother's nervous breakdown happened, you know, the big collapse that...
Oh, wow, that ties her to your mother,
so, you
right?
I'm staring at the skylight, looking at the Nova Scotia sky, and, you know, just thinking, well, this is what she saw.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying like I channeled her or anything, but there was certainly, you know, some energy there that got created by that.
Own it, man. You probably did channel her. How can you, you know, lay in the same position looking up at her sky, you know, without there being some remnant of her, you know, and
right.
Even beyond, you know, our egos, you know, that create a connection. You know, the fact is you're looking up into something that's way beyond us, some archetypal image that human beings connect to. That's really beautiful. I used to sleep in Philip Levine's bed when I lived in his house, and I couldn't help but think that, you know, as I'm laying in bed, you know, what did he think when he heard that train in the distance? You know, what did he think, you know, when he hears the drip coming from the kitchen? And I don't know if it made my writing any better, but I believed it did. And belief can certainly drive us to do amazing things.
Yep. And that, you know, I've been writing more formal poems with the last two books, and this book in particular. And I remember one thing I had in my head was the form, the rondo form. And so several of the poems in the book are not clean rondos, but variants, because I was just playing with a syllabic structure and a rhyme scheme as in that poem. And so that's a very tight little formal poem, you know, for me.
Wow, that's interesting. Because if you thumb through this book, you know, just looking at the shapes of the poems before even looking at anything, you know, any of the detail, there's a lot of couplets, but mostly it looks like it's just all free verse. But then you get into the poems and you realize you are indeed playing with form. Like you have this one called the Triolet for Joseph. It's an 8-line poem. The first line is repeated in the fourth and seventh line, and then the second line is repeated in the final line. And it's just such a wonderful example of the triolet. And by the way, I had to look that up. It's not that I knew the form before I read it, but it's such perfect practice of form. And I'm wondering how you reconcile this doing the forms and then just doing the free verse. And does the poem decide?
For me, I decide I'm going to write a formal poem first. Mm. And so I kind of have to scan out on a piece of paper, okay, this many syllables, this many lines, this is the refrain line, or if it has that aspect to it. So I need kind of an outline when I write formal poems.
Right.
You know, I suppose Heaney didn't need them because he had that stuff all, you know, all memorized.
Right,
you know,
right.
But you know, being somebody who comes from the world of free verse and still mostly writes in free verse, I kind of need these crib sheets. That poem in particular kind of came out of, you know, being a stepdad and coming to that. And one thing that fascinates me about different artistic interpretations of Joseph over the centuries is how he's placed within you know, the circle of him, Mary, and Jesus, right? And mm-hmm. so Mary and Jesus are fairly typically in the Pietà kind of, you know, format, you know, Jesus being held by Mary and halos and all of that. But in various interpretations over the centuries, Joseph sometimes looks jealous, sometimes mm-hmm. looks like an old, you know, scared man, sometimes looks, you know, sometimes is involved with the two and has a halo himself. So there's all these different interpretations. And you think, well, yeah, you know, what might Joseph have been thinking? Am I a cuckold? Have I, you know, taken on some other guy's child here? Or is this indeed a miracle? Or and so you can kind of see all these different Josephs over time. And as somebody who suddenly had a stepson out of nowhere.
Right.
And, you know, so in a way, it's kind of a working through that via Joseph. And you know, as the poem says, you know, he kind of disappears from the gospel shortly after the birth of Jesus. So what's become of him? Has he died?
That's right, yeah.
Left? Has, you know, what happens to Joseph?
I think in general, when poets do forms and put the form before the poem, they tend to be a little bit less personal. And seemingly, this poem is like that. But really, the personal did happen because it's an identification with Joseph. It's putting yourself into Joseph. And it just kind of goes to show that when you really know your craft and when you really write poetry, study it and write it and teach it and study it and write it, you can't help but for the meaning to just burst out of the form anyway. So it's a fantastic poem.
Thank you.
I have to ask about this one because, you know, I consider you my friend, not just my Facebook friend, but I feel a friendship between us. Anyway, the Toni Morrison poem. I know that you used to work for Toni Morrison for many years, and I could do a whole show on what that must have been like. But this poem is a found poem. At least I'm assuming it's a found poem, and it's called mm-hmm. Poem from Titles in Toni Morrison's Library, and it's just a list of books. As a reader, and I'm
not
sure...
Not just a list of books.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. It is a list of books. And as a reader, and I'm sure you're absolutely aware, I'm going to look at the titles and try to somehow make a connection between the meaning of the titles and the experience of Toni Morrison or the spirit of Toni Morrison or the spirit of the experience of working for her. So can you explain how you chose these titles and how it expresses something about either Toni Morrison or about how you worked for her?
Well, how much time do you have?
Give us the short version.
I'll try to condense it. So I indeed did work for Toni Morrison for 9 years as her personal assistant. And one of the first jobs, her house had burned down just before I went to work for her, and it had been rebuilt, and she wasn't living in it yet. I actually lived there the first year, and it didn't have a C of O. I was illegally living there. But one of the first jobs she had me do was to restock her new library shelves. And so I'm opening these boxes of books, and for whatever reason, I took out a pad and a pen and decided to jot down the titles that interested me.
Nice.
And I wasn't sure why. I think I thought I might get a poem out of it somehow, you know, some sort of a found poem, which is not something that I do typically. So I did. And then I put it in a box, and then I moved somewhere, and then I moved somewhere else, and then I moved somewhere else. And it wasn't until I ended up here in North Carolina, and I had a break, and I was going to go to the Outer Banks and take my tent and camp out for a few days to write some poems with my wife's blessing. And I grabbed this box that I knew had some prompts in it, and that list happened to be in there. And
oh, wow.
So I got in the tent, and there were mosquitoes all around, so you couldn't do anything else. And I had a half a case of wine and this box of prompts and a bunch of yellow pads, and stuck my hand in the box, and this is the first thing I pulled out. And I was like, well, what do I do with this?
Oh, that's a fantastic story.
And then I started looking at the titles, and a narrative began to emerge. Mm. And, of course, I had Toni in mind. And I also had what Toni is about in mind. You know, so this collection of titles ended up creating a narrative that I thought equaled a poem. But I was very unsure of it, again, because I hadn't done anything like this. And so I put it away. And it wasn't until Natasha Trethewey brought me down to Emory to give a reading. And Natasha's hero is Toni, and I knew that. So I figured, if I'm ever going to break this poem out, now's the time. So I read it down there, and Natasha liked it very much. And I figured, well, if it's okay for Natasha, it's
absolutely
okay for me. And ended up publishing it in a journal, I don't remember where, and putting it in the book. And Auburn University has created a broadside of this poem that'll be for sale from their museum.
Oh, nice, nice. And let me read the first line. Mm-hmm. The tongues of angels, the farming of bones. Beautiful. Fantastic. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I was wondering if you'd be willing to read, since we talked about it, Sleeping in Elizabeth Bishop's Bedroom.
Sure. Sleeping in Elizabeth Bishop's Bedroom. In the room that used to be hers, next to the room of her mother's scream, I'm staring at the ceiling. My dream had begun on a wing of moonlight, shadows in the room, across the road, a car door slams. All I hear from my wife and son, asleep next door, is the box fan whirring softly as a whisper. But I'd heard the church bell clanging, and I had awakened to fire. I'd heard someone's urgent hushing from the kitchen below. Mother, I could see in white flames. Other than that, nothing is the matter.
That was John Hoppenthaler reading Sleeping in Elizabeth Bishop's Bedroom from his new book, Domestic Garden. John, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Had a great time, Daniel. Thank you.